about all things Messianic Judaism. Each episode, we will be sharing our opinions as we tackle some of the biggest issues in Messianic Judaism. Now, here's your hosts, Rabbis Eric, David, Jonathan, and Toby. Hey guys, thanks for joining us for another episode of the Messiantics podcast. We're going to dive into a conversation that we broached on a break in between recordings. For those that don't know, we generally get together and record two episodes at a time, just so that we can have some in pocket in case something comes up, an emergency or a shift to schedule or whatever. And so we always will take a quick break, go kind of refill our coffee, recalibrate, come back in, and it often ends up being that we end up in a conversation on the break that we come back in and went, man, that would have been a good episode. So we decided that that's what we're doing today. We're going to take that conversation and continue it. And so in essence, what we were discussing was Messianic Jewish outreach. It's a grand archetype of conversation, but Messianic Jewish outreach, what is, what isn't, what's effective, what's not effective, etc. And what kind of brought this conversation up was we were talking about congregational Passover Seders, big congregational Passover Seders, which a lot of Messianic synagogues do. A lot of Messianic Jewish missional and outreach organizations will go into churches and do them, put them on, and so on. It's a big part of the ministry every year and what's happening. And so we were internally talking about Passover Seders because Maim Chaim does one every year. Brit Am did for years, and the last few years have not done one. And we were talking about why they decided to stop doing it, why we then continued to do it, and what our thought processes and stuff were. But it brought me about to this conversation, and we're going to launch from Passover into this conversation and kind of see where it goes.
This episode drops, Passover will have passed.
Potentially, yeah.
Or be right at the week of Unleavened Bread.
And so it brought me to this. And I think it's important for us to have a dialogue for real on what actually is outreach. What is Messianic Jewish outreach? How do we reach into the Jewish community, into the greater community as a whole with the message of Messiah? Because I grew up in, as you guys have heard our stories in the past, and maybe one day we'll do another episode on our backgrounds or something, but you guys have heard our individual stories in the past. I grew up in Messianic Judaism. This is more or less all I've ever really known. And I've grown up in a number of kind of progressions of Messianic Judaism. And so for most of my life, Messianic Jewish outreach wasn't so much let's go out into the community and do things, but rather how can we get butts in seats at our stuff, right? And so I remember the days with all of the High Holy Day marketing was free seats for the High Holy Days, no tickets necessary, et cetera, because in traditional Reform conservative synagogues, et cetera, you have to have your dues paid up, you have to buy your tickets in advance, you pay more money for better seats and yada, yada, yada. And so a lot of people aren't able to go because they don't have the money or tickets are sold out before they get around to it or whatever. And so that big marketing push every year for the High Holy Days
can't afford the seats by the Eastern Wall.
Exactly. And so all of the marketing was, for the High Holy Days was free seats. Come and join us. No tickets necessary, etc. Passover Seder is viewed, are often viewed as big outreachings. I remember when growing up in Tree of Life in Mobile, when you were the rabbi there, Dad, that we had what we called our outreach team. And our outreach team was really the groups that we had trained and would send out to do Passover Seders at churches. It wasn't actually going out to do outreach into the community. It was, we went and did Passover Seders, or we went and did teachings on the High Holy Days in churches or whatever. But we call that our outreach team. And so over the years, I've kind of spent some time processing what exactly is outreach. How do we do it? Are we doing it? And for our congregation, and this is where our conversation had kind of gotten to when I said, oh, hold on, let's just hit record and run with it. For CMC, we started reevaluating things a few years back and went, you know what? Are our Holy Day services outreach efforts? Like, is it really, is our goal really to get Jewish people in the service? Or are we doing these things because God said to do it? And if Jews or non-Jews come in and hear about Messiah, that's great. That's awesome. Like, that's a hope of ours. But are we doing this supposedly as an outreach thing to get Jewish people to come in? Or are we doing this for God? And if we're doing it for God, just because God said do it, then we need to have that as our primary objective. And then we need to focus on other things as outreach efforts and opportunities. And one of the things that hit me was,
at least in our area, in Pensacola, is pretty similar. I'd pretty much say the whole like Gulf Coast area of the Panhandle of Florida into Alabama, Mississippi, even broaching into Louisiana. It's pretty much a similar concept that most of the Jewish people, I would say probably 98% of the Jewish community in the Gulf Coast area, could give a crap less about the religious practice of Judaism, right? The overwhelming majority aren't showing up for the High Holy Days anyways. I think the conservative reform synagogues in Mobile, if memory serves, boast about a 500 to 600 person membership in each of the congregations. They're lucky if they have 15, 20 people show up on a Shabbat. They're lucky if they have, you know, 300-400 show up for the High Holy Days. Out of almost 25,000 Jewish people in the Mobile Baldwin County area, that's what shows up, right? So at least 95, 98% of the Jewish community on the Gulf Coast could give a crap less about Jewish religion and practice. They don't want the religiosity. They don't want all of that. Yeah. But what they will participate in is culturally Jewish experiences, right? And so we talked about on one of our previous episodes dealing with Passover and Easter is – an overwhelming majority of the Jewish community in the world will celebrate Passover, will have a Passover Seder, not because of the religious aspect, but because of the cultural aspect. Yeah. This is what we do. We eat matzo bowl soup. We wait a really long time talking about a lot of stuff that we don't really know while we wait for our food, right?
We put chosid on a cracker. Yeah.
When do we eat? The four questions. Let's do the four questions. When do we eat? But what we've determined is Purim, you know, the celebration of the events of the Book of Esther and Hanukkah are culturally Jewish experiences, not so much religiously Jewish experiences, although there's a religious aspect to both of them, but they're really culturally Jewish experiences. And non-believing Jews will come to a culturally Jewish experience put on by Messianic congregations because it's something Jewish in their area, right? And it gives us an opportunity. They're there. It gives us a chance to share Messiah. It's our thing. Like if we show up at a public menorah lighting that Chabad puts on, which we do often. If we show up for stuff like that, we show up to support the Jewish community. We don't go there to try and evangelize. We're not there to try and push the gospel down people's throats. But when it's our public menorah lighting, we can put on a show. We can do it upright. Yeah. We can really share Messiah. And we see people show up, right? Because this is the only thing happening in the area that's culturally Jewish. I want to be a part of it. Let's do it. And so that's kind of some of the focus that we've shifted some, and there's other things that we want to do. But I just thought, hey, let's dive into this conversation. What is Messianic Jewish outreach?
Yeah. As we discussed just before we hit the go button, our congregation actually before COVID hit had decided we were not going to do a Passover Seder in a large one like we'd been doing. We for many years had done it. We built it to where we were having about 700 people come to our Seder, which for numbers wise was very successful. Mm-hmm. But we noticed a couple of things. One, as a result of the Seder, we weren't having more people come to our synagogue. Number two, as a result of the Seder, we weren't having more people accept Yeshua. And the third thing we realized, which I didn't get to share when we were talking previously, is that most of the people in our synagogue were not doing a home Seder. They had decided that they would just come to our Seder, and that would be their Seder. Done. So, and Rabbi David said something really powerful earlier, and that's that the holy days on Yom Teruah or Rosh Hashanah, we're commanded to gather together to celebrate and hear the shofar. On Yom Kippur, it's a time to gather together. But Passover was a time to gather together in your house with your family and have the family do a Seder commemorating where the fathers or the grandfathers or whoever is the head of the household answers the questions to the children every year, why do we do this? And so we weren't having that. It had changed to where our Passover Seder became the time where I told the story to everybody in the congregation. But the fathers or the grandfathers in the home weren't actually answering the questions to their mm-hmm. children, doing what the scripture actually said. So we decided that what was kingdom profitable isn't so much are we seeing growth in the numbers, because we had growth in numbers. 700 is not a bad crowd to have in an event.
Right.
But we weren't seeing kingdom growth in families actually having the fathers being and the mothers actually sharing with their children, actually doing what the scripture said in their home. And so we said what we'd like to do is for everybody to have a Seder at your home. We'll show you how. We'll provide Haggadot for you. We'll do all the things we can do to make that happen and facilitate it. But then we want you, instead of inviting your friends to come to a big event at a conference center with a big meal, invite them to your house and let them be part of your family Seder, where you intimately and personally relate the story of the Exodus of Israel from Egypt and the Exodus of your family from ungodliness and unrighteousness to holiness. And so that became our outreach. Our outreach was to, you know, first you start at the household of God and then you go out. So I wanted our families to establish that Passover Seder was a family function. That's what the Bible teaches. And then for them to reach out to loved ones, to friends and others, and share the message intimately and personally in a way that isn't going to cost. Because if you tell somebody, if you pay $30, $40, $50 to come to this meal, I'll then share the Passover story mm-hmm. with you. That got to be something where it grated yeah. at me, where if you invite people to come to your house and you serve the traditional meal and you go through the Passover Seder with them, you're inviting them to your table, and the outreach is not just to churches or whatever, but it's to unbelievers and believers, welcoming them to share the thing in your home. And instead of having one event where 700 people gather together, you have 100 or 150 events where smaller groups gather together in homes and hear the story the way the Bible expressed for us to do it. And I found that to be more mm-hmm. kingdom profitable than having a big Seder. Now, that doesn't mean that we won't ever go back to having
yeah.
a large community Seder, but I wanted our congregation to establish the home Seder is the most important mm-hmm. thing, and then the community Seder is a secondary way of sharing in a larger way, in a community way. But if we don't do it the home thing, we're not obeying the Torah.
Yeah.
Even if we have a large yeah. Seder.
Yeah, we encourage people at CMC to do home Seders on the first and or second night, and to invite friends and family over and other people in the congregation that, you know, don't have somewhere to be for it or what have you. And then we also do the big Seder as a secondary thing. But I have the same mentality about the Shabbat. Like, I don't like Erev Shabbat services. Like, I mean, I like them. They're fun. They're great. But I don't like Erev Shabbat services in a Messianic congregation for a couple of reasons. The primary is that I don't think you can do an Erev Shabbat service and people actually enter the Shabbat restfully, like peacefully. Because most people are coming from work. They're rushing to get changed. They're rushing to get food. They're rushing to get to synagogue. They're rushing. It's just a constant hurry, 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 hurry. And by the time they get there, they're stressed out.
Right.
And they're not able to just relax. But like we encourage, we do Shabbat morning service like you guys do. We do Shabbat morning services, and we encourage everybody to do Erev Shabbat dinner at home. And again, to invite friends, family, coworkers, whatever over, because I look at Erev Shabbat as the prime opportunity for a non-confrontational way of introducing people to Shabbat, introducing people to the Lord of the Shabbat, introducing people to Messiah and what that means to us.
Right.
Which again is, it's not a, you know, go out and street preach at cars kind of a thing. You know, a lot of people have these weird, what is outreach? What is evangelism? And it's this really weird, like, you know, you got to shove down people's throats things. But people will show up for a free meal, right? Have them come to your house. Come celebrate. They'll celebrate Shabbat with you. They'll see it. They'll see the imagery. You can explain it as you go.
Come to a candlelit dinner.
Exactly. And then you get to have conversation over dinner about Messiah, about what the Shabbat means and so on. But it's in a non-conference. It's not at the synagogue. It's not. It's at your home. You can, you know.
Right. And I think it also adds this level of importance to the family.
Mm-hmm.
This is something where this is our family doing this because it's important to us, mm-hmm. not just we're part of a congregation and this is what we do on Saturday morning or Saturday evening. The other reason I like doing just Saturday morning instead of Friday evening and Saturday is that you end up where you have two separate congregations that don't ever meet each other.
Yeah.
And largely the Friday night becomes your middle age group, because your seniors don't drive at night. They're not going to go out. The children, it's bedtime. They're going to bed already. So you have this middle age group of people that are there on Friday night. And then your Saturday morning becomes your seniors and your families,
right?
With children. And I like to have everybody all at once.
This massive age gap.
Yes.
Or at least for, you know, a good half hour, 45 minutes of the service all at once, because they come in and wave.
Right, yeah. So that's the reason we do. Yeah, we have, I jokingly say we have two congregations, the 10 o'clock congregation and the 10:20 congregation.
Yeah.
But their understanding of the Shabbat, the Erev Shabbat, yeah. Is the whole and Havdalah also, which is a home celebration, is the reason I wrote the simple Shabbat Siddur for people to do that, because we want to encourage people to have a simple yet meaningful Erev Shabbat with their family and Havdalah with their family, and then gather together with their community on Saturday morning, at least in our communities.
Yeah.
And again, there's people that argue and go all about, should we have just home groups? Should we have this? Should we have, or are mega congregations biblical? All these arguments. The reality is that in the book of Acts, we see them going house to house, breaking bread. That's what we're talking about. Erev Shabbat, that's the Passover Seder. It's having the meals together, talking together, non-confrontationally sharing both the love of Messiah and the love of Messiah's people with those that are invited to your house. Then there's synagogues, local communities gathering together to worship together, families gathering together with other families to become a larger family. And then there's the temple, which was the mega congregation of mega congregations. There were millions of people that gathered at the temple. So we have home groups, we have synagogue groups, smaller community groups, and mega congregations. In today's society, we have Erev Shabbats, where we gather together with our families and others. We have synagogue service on Shabbat morning, where we gather together with our community. And then we have conferences, where we gather together with believers from other congregations, where, you know, sometimes there's thousands of people gathered together to worship. And all three of those are necessary to have the biblical basis and biblical balance that the scripture teaches us.
I think here's the thing, because we began this episode with the question, what is Messianic Jewish outreach? Mm-hmm. Here's the interesting thing. I think that, and I don't want to go into the church, like a deep dive into the church. This is about Messianic Judaism. I just think the church has the same issue with outreach as far as the wrong approach. Their whole thing is bring a friend to church, because you can bet on it that most likely the pastor is going to have some time carved aside with asking the question, if you have, or saying the statement, if you have never accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Savior. Now, that's not a bad question. And one of my favorite pastors, and I'll, you know, Charles Stanley, blessed memory, he passed away last year. He always says that. You know, he'll give an incredible message, and then he'll stop and say, if you've never accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, I have never asked that question or put that forth in a message to date. And the reason why is because I believe that the responsibility of the pastor in the church, or in, let's, you know, we're talking about Messianic Jewish, a rabbi, is not to deliver a salvation message at the synagogue. My messages, and even Rabbi David's, are always to encourage the believers.
Right.
Mostly, I would say 99.9% of what I say is to believers that are out there in the world, that have to go out into the world.
Right.
So that leads me to, what do I think about what Messianic Jewish outreach is? Well, I think that most outreach in general for Messiah Yeshua, he sent them out, not into buildings. He sent them out. So what I'm saying is that, and in my experience, most of my evangelism and times of sharing the Lord was always in the marketplace. It was always
exactly
out there in the marketplace. So I think that, and I think that that is in line with what Rabbi David and Rabbi Eric said, which was, we aren't using our corporate events like Seders and things like that to be replacements, because I think that you're going to have a better shot reaching someone by inviting them to your home,
right?
And see, because here's the thing: anybody can go to an event and put a game face on and just and disappear into a crowd of 700. But what a non-believer would see, and whether they're non-believing Jewish, but of course non-believing Jewish is a very important part of the it's the first mission of the Messianic Jewish movement, to the Jew first and equally to the non-Jew. But what I think, if I were a non-believer, I want to know, okay, I get that you go to this big event, but what are you doing at home? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's why when you come to CMC, you, chances are, unless God's really put something on me or Rabbi David's heart, you're not going to hear a salvation message.
Yep. Yeah.
Because I don't think that's the purpose of the synagogue. I don't think that's the purpose of the synagogue. The purpose of the synagogue, I think, is to exhort, encourage, teach, and correct, and then send out.
Yeah,
right. Well, and because you know, the synagogue, the second part of the synagogue, and I always tell people this, you know, the synagogue is equally a house of worship as it is a house of education. Mm-hmm. It is, and if it's not,
that's why we call it a shul.
If you don't have that, like I get it. If you're like a plant and you're like just starting up, and all you can afford is the rent for the 3 hours on Saturday from the church you're renting from to do a worship service, that's fine. But if you've been in place for 4 or 5 years and all you can do is a worship set, like a worship service, and you aren't making any dedicated effort to have teaching and studies outside of that, then you are failing as a synagogue. You are not a synagogue.
But even at that, like, I can tell you from experience in planting CMC, like, we only had availability for our weekend service, our Shabbat service, and that was it with the building we were using.
Right.
But we still did, like, Bible studies and things. I just opened my house
up for
it.
There's a will, there's a way. Right. And so, you know, the thing is, like, a lot of these things, like the big community Passover Seders, they are better as educational tools than mm-hmm. they are really out. Because statistically, they are not good outreach things.
Yeah, I don't think supposed to be.
Not anymore. They used to be. Like, when we first started.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The point of this conversation is, like, now we've gotten to this. We've gotten
to a point.
Yeah, yeah. The phase in the here and the now phase. No time like the present. And the Messianic movement is that these are now more or less educational opportunities for Christians. The occasional, like, straggling Jew will wander in, but for the most part, they end up being in line with the educational part, not so much the outreach to people part.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest handicaps that the Messianic Jewish movement has, is for the most part, we're so hung up on, well, this used to work, or this has always worked. And I think it's time that, you know, we're, what, 50-something years into the congregational Messianic Jewish movement,
right,
as we know it today. It's probably time that we start evaluating, hey, this maybe did work, maybe. I'll leave that loose, because some things, there's not a lot of evidence that it actually worked. But, you know, maybe this worked. Okay, great. But is it still working? No? Right. Then why are we still doing it? Like, you know, to piggyback on what Rabbi Toby was saying, I talk about this a lot at CMC. I do not think, you know, that you've got the seeker friendly model of the kind of mega church movement. This idea that we've got to every service, every sermon has to be focused on presenting the gospel, so that people raise their hand and repeat after me, so they can get dunked on every 3 months when we do a baptism service or whatever, right? And so there's this idea that it has to be done that way, that the sermon has to be a salvational thing. And I actually steal this phrase from Rabbi Scott Sekulow, who passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. He was a really good friend of my father's and of mine. I've known him for years. And he was speaking at Brit Am a number of years back, I think at a Sukkah Fest or something like that. But he was speaking at Brit Am a while back, and he said, you know, the reality is that the local congregation is for raising up sheep. It's for the rabbi's job is to shepherd sheep, but only sheep can produce more sheep. Mm-hmm. It's not the rabbi's job to produce more sheep. It's not the synagogue or the church's job to produce more sheep.
Right.
It's the sheep's job to produce more sheep, right? The Great Commission, as we like to call it, is to the average person in the body of Messiah. It's not only to the leadership echelon. It's to each and every, it's a command from Messiah for each and every one of us to go to the community. I think you're 100% right, Rabbi Toby. It's the congregation is for building up the community of believers. That's what the local synagogue is for building up, educating the local believing, you know, the believing community, and to get together to foster an atmosphere of worship communally, because there's a necessity for communal worship. And then from there, we're to be recharged in that environment on Shabbat so that we can go into the ordinary week, kind of like we close out Havdalah with the close out Shabbat with Havdalah, and the spice box goes around. And you know, the idea is that we smell the sweetness of it, and our prayer is that the sweetness of the that this symbolically will remind us that the sweetness of this Shabbat will carry us to the next,
right?
And so the sweetness of the corporate experience and the worship and the reinvigoration in that service would carry us through the week, because we still have a responsibility in the week to go to our workplace, to go to the gas station, to go to the grocery store, to be the hands and feet of Messiah in the community, because salvation should occur out there,
right,
outside the walls of the country, and then bring them in for them to be sheep being led from milk to meat.
Yeah, absolutely. At our synagogue, and again, we don't do everything perfect. There's no perfect congregation, but we have our worship and teaching, which is all directed at the congregation. And then we have fellowship time, which is all directed at building community mm-hmm. with our congregation. We always welcome visitors, and we want them to be there, but our design is to build a community there. Then we have things like Torah studies, which we don't do at our synagogue. We do them at local coffee houses.
On purpose,
so we're purposely out in the community. You guys mm-hmm. do Torah on tap. Out in the community, we did.
Well, that's not a synagogue thing, but yes.
Well, yeah.
For a number of years, we did a thing where we called it worship in the park, where all we did was go with some of our worship team people and play worship in a city park. We got permission to come. We didn't bring tracks. We didn't bring handouts. We didn't bring anything. We just gathered around together as people having a good time and sang songs, and other people would just gather around with us, and if they joined in and clapped hands or whatever, great, but they were there, and it was a way of saying we're part of the community, and if somebody asked a question, we answered, but it wasn't the purpose to gather a crowd so we could hand invitations to the congregation. It was we're part of this community, and we want to share what we have. We want to let our light shine and let the light of God cause a reaction in the people around us. Same thing, we go into prisons. We don't have any expectation that the people in the prison are going to come to our synagogue. Mm-hmm. But we
that sounds outreach. Bad when you say it that way. I'm just...
Well, I mean, because these people are in prison.
No, that's what I'm saying.
The truth is, we have several people in our synagogue that came out of the prisons in our area that are now active members of our synagogue and part of what goes on and welcomed there.
It just sounded funny the way when
but
you said
But the purpose is to minister, to do outreach outside of our community and do that. We provide meals to homeless 2 days, sometimes 3 days a week. And while we would welcome any of the homeless to come to our synagogue and worship with us, that's an outreach. We're showing and demonstrating the love of God outside the walls of our synagogue, not on a transactional basis, but on a basis of love. It's not about we're feeding you so you will come to our synagogue, but this is what our synagogue is supposed to do. And so we're going to do this. So 2 or 3 times a week, we provide meals to the homeless in our community. But it's outreach. Reaching outside of where we are.
Reach out of the cultic circle.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, I'm just saying, I think I've only in 20 years in the Messianic movement, I've only seen 2 situations where I saw someone get saved, like at the end of a service, and that's twice, which tells me that most of that kind of business is done outside. That's not a criticism on the synagogue I was mm-hmm. at. It's just I think that most of that happens outside.
Yeah.
Right.
I saw a video on social media, I think it was this morning, that I thought the concept was interesting. I didn't like the approach. The concept was interesting. But it was a church in, I want to say it was like the Nashville area or something like that, that they said about once every quarter they're trying to do intentional things as outreach, but not as much of like a in-your-face outreach thing, but trying to do intentional things to give into the community around them, like to financially bless the community around them and stuff. And so one of the things that they've been doing is once, I think they said once a quarter, they will go to a gas station or a couple of gas stations, a bigger church, but they'll go to a couple of gas stations. They basically just take over the gas station for the day for, you know, 6 hours or whatever. And every car that comes through, they pay for their gas. The church pays for their gas. And they'll have some people outside with signs, you know, free gas, you know, from, you know, blessing from whatever the church is. And people, and they just keep running cards or run a tab at the counter or whatever it is and pay for it. And I thought that's a really neat idea, especially right now, because gas is
tell
nuts
you what,
and
if
people
you,
are hurting.
If you ever wanted to create a religion around Trump,
oh God,
do that.
Oh, that went south quick.
That would do. Well, some people haven't, but come on.
But yeah. But the and I thought, you know, the concept, not a bad concept. Like, I actually like it. I be hard to raise enough money to make it worthwhile for people because you need to dump thousands of dollars.
I think if you posited it to people, though, like they would
donate.
People, yeah, people might would jump on board. People outside of the, especially like people who watch online, because you both of our synagogues have people who have lived nowhere near us, but they watch online and are faithful, even faithful givers online, and they might would be like, man, that's something I can fully commit to and being a part of.
Now, the thing I didn't like in the application of how they did it was that they decided this time around that they were going to take Easter Sunday, and instead of having a service on Easter Sunday, which do with what you want for Easter, I don't really care what you do there. That's your thing. I mean, you can listen to one of our previous episodes that deals with our thoughts on it. But the Easter Sunday, instead of having a service on Easter Sunday, that was the day they chose to go out and put gas in people's cars. And I'm like, okay, I'm down for the idea of being physically active in blessing the community. I'm not down for the idea of robbing our congregation of corporate worship to do so. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we should all be meeting on Shabbat. That's a whole other discussion. But if you're going to have a service on Sundays, you could have done the gas giveaway on Saturday. You could have done it on Monday or whatever. Why did it have to be on a Sunday morning and you cancel your service?
One of the highest services
supposed
of the year.
To be, the most important service of the year for you. Why did you have to cancel your service to do that? It just seems absurd to me.
Yeah, and I think that some of the things that we decided to do at our congregation, some of the things you guys do also, was we determined that outreach was, and this, listen when I say this, outreach was not sharing a message of the gospel, mm-hmm. but outreach was doing the message of the gospel.
Yeah,
and so when we go and feed the homeless, we're doing the message of the gospel, and because of that, we have people that want to hear more about what we do. We're part of a thing that helps with foster care and adopted families called Care Portal, where when somebody is taking care of a foster child or has adopted a child and they need a bed or they need clothes or they need something, that it reaches out through this portal, through this app.
Care Portal.
Care Portal, and we can send them what it is. Now, that's doing the gospel, and which is sharing the gospel. Mm-hmm. But many outreaches are just sharing the gospel without doing the gospel. And so when we help the homeless, when we help the poor, when we help people in prison, when we do the things that we do, we're doing the gospel, which I think is the definition of outreach, not telling the gospel.
That's why I really like the terminology of being the hands and feet of Messiah. Not the mouthpiece. With the hands and feet.
Yeah, the telling of the gospel, the way it's done today in most evangelical circles, is a fairly recent invention. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like not even really as old as our Civil War. So it's something that is developed late, whereas before, most people just in general were a part of a church to begin with. Like, you were born an Episcopalian. You were baptized as a baby, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Catholic, whatever. And it's a development over time where it's like, well, and it began a lot with, you know, preaching in camps of soldiers, you know, come and receive, you know, essentially come and receive, you know, salvation before you go off and get killed on this battlefield. And there was a semi-revival that was birthed out of that. And I think it's the Second Great Awakening that happens after that. and where this develops over time into this, like, it's not a church service, it's not a worship service until you get this, like, salvation message of believe on the name of Christ, you know, and receive salvation today. And it really comes into flower after the Second World War, you know, 1950s and on. It really becomes like the main meat of how to get people to become Christians, in, at least in America. Because if you go to any other part of the world, unless it's an American missionary group, like, that is not the Christianity that exists anywhere else in the world. Like, it is pretty much only an American thing.
One of the best means of outreach that I've ever done is tipping at restaurants.
Yeah, there you go.
But not just tipping, but we'll, a lot of times, and it depends on the person, how busy they are and all, but a lot of times when we get ready to pray, we'll ask the server, is there anything we can pray for you about while we're doing this? But that's a really important thing to do if you can do it. But beyond that, if you then eat your meal, spend an exorbitant amount, because believers tend to stay at the table a lot longer than other people because we're talking.
Abusing their waitress.
And then leave a track and a dollar tip, or, you know, a minuscule tip. Yeah. And but when you, if you pray for, so if you present yourself as a believer, and then you don't act as a believer by giving that person what their worth is, then you're diminishing your testimony, and you're in a real way blaspheming the presence
of
Spirit.
Not only that, but as somebody that's spent almost 20 years waiting tables and bartending, I'm going to tell you offhand right out the gate, if you're going to open your mouth to that server about prayer, about your faith, about whatever, you better live it the entire time you're at that table.
You better be the best customer ever.
Do not, you know, I've witnessed so many people go, hey, we're about to pray over our food. Is there something we can pray for you, right? Because this became this big thing in the body to do this as like a mode of outreach of sort. Yeah.
2000 or
something. And they can, what can we pray for you for? And then they'll spend the rest of the really genuine, nice thing. Then they'll spend the rest of the meal treating the server like trash, running them to death, not caring. You're my servant. That's all you're here for. Yeah. You know, do not put the name of God in your mouth in front of them and then treat them like they're below you the entire time that you're there. Because I promise you, you can pray for them at the beginning and you can leave them a killer tip at the end. But if you don't do right in between, none of that will matter.
It will not make
a difference.
Right.
Yeah.
I
reached
twice.
Rabbi Eric brought up tracts, and I don't know if it's still a big thing now. It was a big thing in the 90s when I was in middle school, junior high, because I remember we had to spend a whole day, our youth group did, going to, I remember I was in front of Kroger, a grocery store.
Kroger.
Yeah.
Man.
But I mean, so we're passing these, I mean, they gave us these big tracts, this big stack of tracts. Let me explain something to you. Those tracts, and any tract, is small. Now, what does that tell me? It tells me this. Something that's really true. The gospel is an incredibly simple concept in the sense that you realize that you're a sinner.
Right.
You tell God that you're a sinner. You realize you have no way to afford making yourself right in his sight unless you accept the payment he made to redeem you.
Right.
And he sent his son who died, so he took the hit. He took the punishment. So you can be brought into God's kingdom and be adopted by him as one of his children.
Right.
I just explained the whole gospel. And then you receive the Holy Spirit to help guide you and to help make you understand this, help you understand the difference between right and wrong and all those things. That's your launching point. You can put that on a tract. The gospel is, I think, meant to be simple. The thief on the cross got saved in seconds. My son accepted the Lord when he was 7 in the bathtub. He told Brooke, he goes, I want the Lord to be in my heart. I want to accept him. So what I'm saying is that it's meant to be a simple thing. So what I'm saying is that you give a person a tract and go, oh, I've done my duty. That's easy, man. Yeah. Explaining the gospel is, it is an, the God is a mystery, and the Bible has a lot of things that are very difficult to understand. Like it, like David said, from milk to meat, but milk is supposed to be easy to ingest. The message of God's love in the gospel is easy to ingest. It's a great message.
Right.
It's like when some people say, man, if that's true, it's like when Joe Rogan said on one of his shows, when a Kid Rock asked him, do you want to meet Jesus? He goes, I like the idea. If it's real, man, that's incredible. So it's a good message.
Right.
But outreach is not just giving somebody a piece of paper that has that message on it and say, man, I did it.
It's not a sales pitch. I witnessed, man. Use hard salesman tactics.
So Yeshua didn't say, go and share the gospel. He said to make disciples. Now that is work. And so outreach has to be not just sharing the gospel, but it has to open up the – somehow it has to open up a road to discipleship.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think there's a lot of churches that are getting back to that. One of the reasons I despise that, like the sales pitch model, is because it legitimately is a conspiracy between business owners and churches to, like, how do you have better workers in your businesses? We'll get them to be Christians, and that, like, that's a like the fat documented fact in American history. Like, there was one of the biggest business meetings of the year, 1950s. They had a guy come in and tell them, "We want good workers, make them Christians, simplify the sales pitch, get them to be Christians, they'll be better workers." And it's like, and so to me, that's like this really weird line of like, okay, so you're going to get them to be better workers, but you have no sincere interest in their development and spiritually later on.
Yeah, I can tell you that one of the most depressing moments in my life as a believer was when the guy who led me to faith, who spent 9 months studying with me, praying with me, trying to get me to believe, when I became a believer and he disappeared.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean, he went to go lead somebody else to the Lord. It wasn't, and I don't blame him. That was what he was taught. That was the mode, the method, the operation of the.
Right. But for the record, he didn't necessarily disappear because he's still one of your closest friends.
Right.
But he just stopped putting the effort into you.
Right, which
I think is. Yeah.
His goal wasn't to disciple me.
Right. Yeah.
It was to get me into the product.
It wasn't out of ill intention. It was
It was his good intention. Right. And I love him and we're still friends. I was just talking.
Just in case he listened to it. I didn't want him to.
Right. No. And we're still good friends. Matter of fact, I saw his daughter yesterday. She was here visiting the synagogue. But it's a model. And we have to understand that discipleship, how we live our lives. And again, going back to the restaurant thing. My wife and I recently went to a restaurant that we hadn't been to since before the New Year's. And the server saw us come in and ran up, gave us a hug, and then said, wait here. And she went out to her car and she got a Christmas present that she had got for us, expecting to give it to us in December or January. Now, we don't do Christmas. It wasn't a thing.
You heathen.
But the thing was that our example, our relationship with her was more than she was a servant who brought food to us. But it meant enough to her that she considered us part of the group of people that she would get presents for when she celebrated her holiday. But that's the connection we're looking for with people, is when we become part of their family, part of the people they care enough about, that they are going to go, you know. And so while I don't do Christmas, I was absolutely honored that this person that I interact with once a month maybe or so considered us meaningful enough in her life to buy us a gift. And so it was just my wife broke down crying. It was such a moment for us. But the relationship that we built isn't you're my servant. I come here and I throw a few pennies at you. But we talk to each other. We share each other. It's
alms for the poor.
Really is something different.
So here's the thing too, as we kind of get towards the finish line on this episode, and I think it's important to double back around to something we've talked about a few times now, the idea that the corporate worship experience in the congregation, whether it's in a Messianic synagogue or we have people in the audience that listen that are part of churches, if you go to a church on Sundays, whatever that corporate worship experience is that you're in, that is not supposed to be the salvational experience introduction for people.
Right.
It's not to say people can't come to salvation there, but that's not what its purpose is. And I think a lot of times what we end up doing is we shirk our responsibility. We relegate our responsibility as individual followers of Messiah to, as Rabbi Toby said, to make disciples, not just lead them to the Lord.
Right.
But to make disciples who then turn around and make disciples. We relegate, we shirk our responsibility, we relegate discipleship making to the congregation. And then the congregation as a whole relegates it to the senior leader, the rabbi, the pastor, whatever the shepherd is. And what we end up seeing, or at least what I've seen a lot, and I see it in like the kind of mega church model, is we relegate our responsibility to the shepherd, ultimately. So then the shepherd, instead of being a shepherd leading the flock from milk to meat, instead of the shepherd being able to shepherd the flock, the shepherd has to be an evangelist.
Right.
And has to preach a salvational sermon every single week. Because the metric that we use is how many hands were raised that said, I repeat it after you, right?
Like, hey, I brought my friend, they don't know the Lord, you got to talk about it.
Exactly.
You got to give a good one.
Exactly. And so then the shepherding role, because the shepherd can't shepherd, so the shepherd has to be an evangelist, the shepherding role is then relegated to small groups, because that's where we relegate discipleship to. Again, we relegate salvation, the beginning of the discipleship process, to the shepherd, and then we relegate discipleship to the small group. And so then the small group leaders become shepherds, while the shepherd is an evangelist, and then there's the individual doesn't have any responsibility, no capital involved in the process. But
right.
The reality is the individual is who is responsible for the salvational introduction to discipleship, for the salvational experience, responsible for the discipleship process, modeling that life, living it out. It's a one-on-one thing. It's supposed to be a relational aspect. And then from there, you get them in the congregation. Once they come to faith and they start this discipleship walk, then they go to the congregation. And then the shepherd is able to shepherd the new sheep. Because again, as Rabbi Scott said, only sheep can produce more sheep. That doesn't mean that I, as a sheep of Messiah, can't also produce sheep outside of the congregation. I'm supposed to as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in the congregation, I am a shepherd. My sheep are supposed to produce more sheep and then bring them in that I can help bring them from milk to meat, nourish them, shepherd them, care for them, guide them, etc. But it's an individual responsibility within the corporate experience to build disciples.
Right.
And I think this is really the crux. What is Messianic Jewish outreach? It isn't big events. It isn't any – it is individual relationships, right? I don't know, and my father's story is a prime example, but I don't know a single Messianic Jewish rabbi that I've grown up under in the Messianic Jewish movement that I've looked up to as mentors and examples of the walk and so on, who came to faith because they heard a repeat after me sermon. They came to faith because a fellow believer, or before they were believers, a believer had a relationship with them, and in that relationship led them to the Lord. And it's always been that experience. Everybody I know, you know, you talked about earlier, your best friend, your bunkmate in the military led you to the Lord, and it was a process to get you. There was a relationship built on foundation at the foundation, and then it went from there to something greater. And you guys are still walking with the Lord together. I mean, in different expressions, but still walking with the Lord together today. And everybody that I know came to faith because somebody led them to the Lord. And generally speaking, those types of walks with the Lord are far deeper, far more intentional, far more fruit-bearing earlier in their walk than the ones that simply raised their hand and said, I said a repeat after me prayer, and then went to small groups and, you know, learned how to shoot a rifle or learn how to drink coffee or learn how to whatever. You know, you get small groups dealing with everything that I think we see a far greater fruit that comes forth from an intentionality on the individual level, and then bringing that individual level into the corporate experience. And so I think for me, at least, and you guys can throw in your closing remarks if you'd like, I think for me at least, when we ask the question, what is Messianic Jewish outreach? It needs to stop being the big events as what that is. It needs to start being the individual interactions. It needs to be relationally driven. It needs to be reaching into the community, into our families, into our friends and coworkers, into our classmates, what have you. And starting with, and I talk about this a lot at CMC, starting with living our lives in a way that they see something different in us,
right,
and come to us first.
Right.
I think far too many believers will tell people what they're supposed to do, what they're supposed to be, what they're supposed to look like, but they don't live that example.
Right.
And we need to start living that example so that it's an individual building disciples.
Yeah, because my salvation experience was when I was around 11 years old, I went forward at church. But all the kids that were my age were all doing that, like within months of each other. It was almost like, oh, well, you know, Josh just went up. Oh, but Brett just went up. Oh, you know what? I better do it. You know? It was like that. So I went up and I, you know, made a public profession of faith with my pastor and I got baptized. But that is not the first time I encountered God. That was not. Yeah. That was me doing something that everybody else was doing.
Right.
I think that was the beginning, and I think God used it. I'm not taking away from my pastor or anything like that. It was when I got into youth, and my youth leader, his name was David Floyd, and nobody know, you know, and he's not a world famous guy or this, that, and the other. But the fact is that I saw the way he behaved and the way he talked about God, and even though I was 11 years old, I said, no, he really believes this stuff. And it's real to him, and I want to look at it the way he's looking at it. So I stayed like glued to his side, and then I had a real personal experience with God. But it was because he got that God and that Jesus he talked about, Yeshua, was real. It had nothing to do with, do you want to take Jesus Christ as your personal Savior? It was, no, I want, yes, but I want to do it. I want to act the way he's acting, and I want to talk about God the way he's talking about God, because it's like God's like, it's like he talks to God every day. It's like he walks around with him all the time. It's real,
yeah,
when I'm around him, and then it became real for me, and then we're supposed to make it real for others, you know. So
yeah, I probably the most meaningful experience in my early walk, and again, I became a believer as a result of someone spending a lot of time with me, but even at that, when I became a believer, there was more that I wanted. There was more depth. And one of my friends who'd been a believer longer than I have, who came out of drugs and all kinds of stuff to the Lord, his house caught fire. And I experienced seeing him watch his house burn down and responding with gracious love for God. Mm. And I sat there wondering, How would I have reacted? Is my relationship with God so much that watching everything I own burn up, I would still be faithful to God, still love God, still understand that God loved me, still have faith in what I believed and stand upon it? And it blew my mind that this person had such trust in God. Mm. That he watched everything he had burn up, knowing that he would still not be without, and that God still would take care of him and love him. And that was probably, like you said, an example of, I was like, man, I want that kind of faith in God. I want the kind of faith that something happens that significant and I still hold true to my faith, still trust God, still know he loves me, when the whole world is waiting for me to be like Job's wife.
Yeah, he's not just a God you read about in the book. You mean he's actually like, actually right here.
Right.
And that's how he made me feel. He's like, dude, he's right here.
Yeah, the whole world would have had him be, you know, do like Job's wife. Why don't you just curse God and die?
Right.
But his faith was astounding to me, and that caused me to draw nearer to God.
Yeah, the best words I've heard it put in on outreach is Joshua Aaron's song, Cover the Sea, where he says, you know, let me introduce you to my teacher, the rabbi from the Galilee. You know, and I'm like, that should be every aspect of, you know,
right.
What people are like, why do you keep the Shabbat? Well, it's not because of the Shabbat. It's because of the teacher from the Galilee. You know, why do you bother caring what the Bible says? Well, because of my rabbi from the Galilee, you know, that this is why.
It's just really reflecting the reality of who God is, and not that we believe in these myths in this book, you know, and we're just following these teachings of a really, really good rabbi or whatever. It's no, it's the reality of mm-hmm. who he is. Anyway, so I mean, that's the job of every, and that's why I always, you know, anytime I give a message, I always say, look, you know, you guys are no less important than I am. And you know, so the people that sit in those chairs or sit in pews need to understand that, you know, that's their responsibility. Outreach is their responsibility.
Right. Rabbi's job is to win souls in his world,
right,
in his life. But his primary job beyond that is to encourage and impact the life of his congregants to where they're able to do the same thing. It's our job to prepare, to encourage, to correct, to do all the things so that those that come to our synagogue can go back out into the world and impact their world for Messiah. And with that, we thank you for tuning in. If this has been a blessing, share it with others. If you want to contact us, you can reach us on our Facebook page or comment on any of the platforms that you listen to. Thank you and shalom.
Thank you for listening to the Messy Antics Podcast. Make sure to subscribe so you can be notified every time we drop a new episode. And be sure to follow and interact with us on social media at Messy Antics Podcast.